This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Ruslan, today, on my birthday, is...
Yay! Happy birthday!
Happy birthday!
We have two of Malaysia's finest. He was Malaysia's youngest creative director in the advertising industry 5,000 years ago. And he's been an actor, and I'm trying to persuade him to be a writer. He is Vernon Adrian Amwong.
Hi, thanks for having me on again.
Pleasure. And she's got quite a CV. She was the founder and used to be the head honcho at the Georgetown Literary Festival. She has started Pen Malaysia, which is sort of a writers' union kind of thing. She's a writer, filmmaker, photographer. She is Bernice Shawley.
Hello. Yay. Happy birthday.
Thank you. Enough about
me. I've just realized we've known each other for 30 years, Cam. So, yeah, that's a while. That's a while.
Okay.
Yes.
That's a generation, man. A generation we've known each other. Oh, my God.
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, our three topics this week are topic number one is Captain Speedy. If you don't know who he is, you will find out soon, or was rather. Topic number two is webcasting. And finally, topic number three is Marina Rosales, who was the wife of Francis Light. So topic number one, Captain Speedy, Bernice.
Yes. So Captain Speedy was a kind of a name that I kind of grew up with as a kid in Taiping. And going to Maxwell Hill, there was a bungalow called Speedy's. So it's only recently that I've come to know who he really was. So he was one of the more colorful characters during the Victorian era. He wasn't just in British Malaya, he was also in Abyssinia, now known as Ethiopia, and was stationed in New Zealand for quite a while as well. But here's a quote from William Javois, who was the governor of the Strait Settlements in 18 during the time of the Perak War. So he says this about Captain Speedy. Captain Speedy is altogether an inferior order of being. He has apparently a delight in dressing himself in a gorgeous leopard skin with a grand turban on his head and still further exciting the curiosity of the natives by playing on the bagpipes, an instrument on which he performs with much facility. If you've seen his elephantine frame, you will be able to judge of the figure he would present under those circumstances. So, yes, he was quite a real character, sort of, you know, traipsing around.
Yeah,
Taiping,
something very
yes, wearing a kilt, you know, with this sort of Abyssinian robes and a turban and stuff. But so he was born. So his name is Tristram Charles Sawyer Speedy, or known as Charlie. He was born in India in 1836, and he was known as a Victorian rolling stone by John Gullick, who is one of the foremost writers of British Malaya. And he was the first assistant resident in Perak. So he was assistant to Birch, J.W.W. Birch, who was the first resident of Perak in 1874 after the Pankow Treaty was signed. And we know that Birch was murdered by conspirators who didn't like the way he was running things in Perak. So Speedy was the one who sort of, you know, took after him, and he named Taiping. He was the one who sort of built Taiping, built it up, built the road systems and all that stuff. But he had a really interesting life. So when he was in his 20s, he went to Abyssinia and sort of, you know, worked as a, well, he was with the British cavalry at the time. He was in Peshawar and various other places. But he was summoned by General Napier to Abyssinia because he sort of knew the area and, you know, spoke the language and stuff like that. And Speedy was involved in this Battle of Magdala, which sort of overthrew this king, King Theodore, who shot himself in the head. And King Theodore had a very young son called Alumayo, who was 8 years old at the time. And after, he sort of pillaged this fortress, a lot of the stuff is now in the British Museum, Alamayo became a guardian of the state for Captain Speedy and his wife. So they go back to England, they take this eight-year-old boy with them. He gets married in the Isle of Wight. And then he goes back to India and they take this Abyssinian prince with them. It's just amazing. And Alamayo actually came to Malaya with Speedy in 1871. So he came to Malaya in 1871 because during that time, it was just known as the Straits Settlements. It wasn't British Malaya yet. A lot of the officers were seconded to Malaya on a voluntary basis because a lot of them didn't want to come to Malaya because India was the jewel of the crown. So Speedy arrives with his wife and this prince to Penang, and he's made the superintendent of police in Penang. So he's there for a few years, and then he's called to Larut in 1873 to help quell the last Larut War. So Speedy was kind of known as a mercenary. He basically went where the money was, you know, because he was very tall. He was 6'5".
Which was tall for those days.
6'5". Yeah. Yes, and this sort of like, you know, shock of hair and massive beard. So it was really quite a commanding fleur. And then he stayed on. And so, yeah, he's just a really fascinating character.
Well, can I ask, first of all, Vernon, have you been aware of Captain Speedy over the years?
Not at all.
But you've never seen the name? My family is also from Perak, as is yours, Bernie. So the name is one that's always cropped up. But also in Penang, there was always Captain Speedy's baobab tree.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
I don't even know. I don't
he
think it's there
He planted that tree.
Yeah,
no, it's always, still there.
Oh, is it? And I always saw it. It's like,
I'm not sure what
a strange thing to have in the middle of a road. Captain Speedy's baobab tree. What does that mean?
It's the oldest planted tree in Malaysia. Well, the oldest planted tree. But fascinating character.
But I have to ask the question, Bernice. As a post-colonial person, as a person, yes, of Perak, but of Punjabi Chinese descent, can you legitimately be interested in, and indeed even admiring of one of these old Britishers, these old colonial types?
Well, I think he has a very interesting story. And I've been doing a lot of research on Perak, you know, because I'm very, very, well, I'm just curious and fascinated by this lot that happened to be there in the sort of Victorian era. I think Speedy's story is one of the more interesting ones because he was seen as a renegade in the colonial office. You know, he was very, very unpopular. Javoyce didn't like him. Napier didn't like him. He eventually went back to Africa because they just, you know, he was very unpopular with the other colonial officers. The natives, so to speak.
You said he was a deputy to Birch.
Yes, that's right.
And so
he was
when
Birch's
was
assistant.
Murdered. Oh, assistant. Yes. So when Birch was murdered, what became of him? Did he rise?
He stayed on. No, he stayed on. He stayed on. He wasn't promoted to resident because then Hugh Low came in after that. So there was a sort of a transition period.
If I can interject here. So one of the things about Speedy, he was actually part of a breed that existed throughout the British Empire days. You had people like Sir Richard Burton, the guy who dressed as an Arab horse trader and worked his way into Mecca, and who found the source of the Nile. Even up until people like Lawrence of Arabia. And one of the common denominators of all these people, which is a very English thing, you don't find it in the French empires or the Dutch empires, is they love to dress up. as natives, it was like the empire was just fancy dress party.
It was
actually a very popular pastime in those as well.
They got into the mood. I like that. I like that attitude.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was very flamboyant. I mean, you know, and he had this massive beard, and he spoke Malay, he spoke Chinese, he spoke Urdu. So he brought, you know, sepoys from India, and was the first person to bring in sepoys who became sort of the early descent and ancestors of our bus companies, many transport companies in Malaya at the time. So he was a really fascinating character, but they didn't like him because he was such a rebel.
But he may well have been very popular with the locals, because that's one of the things with Birch is he was not popular with the locals because he was also seen to be arrogant and aloof. Whereas if a guy sort of really got down and kind of like played them, then they like that. Well, he's a fascinating guy. We got to move on though, and we could talk about Captain Speedy.
I'm planning to go to his house. So his house is still around. Very, very good condition in Matang, and I'm trying to get permission to enter his house and hopefully do some more research.
Where's Matang?
Matang. It's just outside Taiping. It's next to the Ngah Ibrahim house. So he worked for Ngah Ibrahim, so they were sort of pals. So
let's make it a culture excursion.
Yeah, sure.
Can do.
We'll hire a bus.
Because the Ngah Ibrahim House is a museum. It's a museum as well.
We'll hire a bus driven by a Punjabi fella. and we'll go up to Captain Speedy's house.
Yes, that's a plan. Yeah,
fantastic. So I'm glad you, because I'd always seen the name, but I actually never really, I'd never looked him up. Anyway, we must move on though to something completely different.
Okay. Completely different. Yes.
Completely different. Vernon, webcasting.
Yeah. Well, in the last 5 weeks, I've been busy webcasting. I kind of like in a matter of 6 days, I decided I was going to do a webcast, like everybody else in this, you know, movement control order days. Everybody stuck at home, nothing to do. And a lot of people got onto the web and started podcasting and stuff like that. And I decided to webcast, and I found it quite an interesting journey, discovering the web apps that were available, figuring out how to work it, and then actually doing it and realizing what an amazing sense of, how shall I say, the democratization of the broadcast facility through the internet via tools and equipment that is so freely available to you. So I'd like to suggest that everybody should get into this wonderful activity of webcasting.
Well, what do you talk about? What do you talk about, Vernon?
Well, what happened was I've been running, as I have mentioned before, I think my first appearance here, I talked about being Sarani, which is a Southeast Asian of European ancestry. Basically, you know, my people are descendants of the Portuguese and various other Europeans who came here and married local women. So for the last 20 years, I have been running a website called Sarani Sembang, where people of my ilk have been gathering and exchanging information about each other's families and discovering our ancestry and genealogical roots. You know, because the European site has evidence of the births and deaths are documented in church documents. So it's really easy to trace, or easier than tracing your Asian ancestry. And so Sarani Sembang was doing that. And on the 20th of June, I discovered 6 days before that was our 20th anniversary. And I thought, you know what? I want to do something special. And I thought, well, the special thing that I'm going to do is what everybody else is doing, which is to webcast. So I organized a couple of people and we did our first webcast. And I enjoyed it so much that we've been doing it, I have been doing it every week for the last, we're going into our sixth week. This Saturday.
Well, one of the things about doing a bit of culture on the radio is that I don't know exactly how many people are not listening to this. I could imagine any number I can imagine. When you're webcasting, you can see right there the tally of numbers, and if it's not a big number, it could be not a fun exercise.
What's interesting is that I'm doing a multi-stream webcast. So like on the YouTube counter, like the last show we did, on the YouTube counter, it showed like 35 people. But on the Facebook counter, I'm not sure whether people can see that. It had 200 people. So I knew that, you know, when we were running it live, we had 200 plus people. All over the world watching us.
So how do you publicize it? So you publicize it on social media, yeah?
I do, but to be honest with you, I've only been publicizing it to my community, the Sarani community, through my Facebook page. So I haven't actually made it a big deal as yet, fiddling with it and you know, I haven't even got my lighting right. So I'm looking horrible. that's fine because I want my guests to be better than me, so that they feel that. Yeah.
Well, Vernon, you have a natural glow about you anyway, so don't you worry. But I would. So what is the particular emotional joy in doing this? Is it just, I don't know, talking out loud into tubes? Is it the connection? What is it?
I guess for me, it's the actual kind of like momentum of creating something every week and trying to come up with ideas as to what to do and bringing people together who've never, you know, worked together or met each other before and getting them talking to each other. So that's been fun. So that's been the joy for me.
Are you tempted, Bernice?
Right. Well, I mean, I'm going to have to be teaching online for like hours and hours starting next month. But that's not necessarily webcasting. So I don't know. I mean, unless I was sort of, you know, lecturing on a particular subject or, you know, history or literature, whatever, poetry, I don't know. It sounds like giving a lecture.
What we're doing here is kind of like a webcast, because we are the kind of thing that I'm doing in Serani Sembang, where I get a bunch of guests together and we talk our identity, our heritage, and what is basically taglined identity, heritage, and authentic chit chat. Because I want us to talk quite openly about what we know about our heritage, which can be quite garbled and mixed up and murky and interesting and scandalous and, you know, but it's all ours. So,
we're going to have to move on, but I just want to say that even though you've taken this opportunity to do self-publicity for your webcasting, and I got to say, hats off to you, but I get the last laugh, because if you had 35 viewers on your broadcast, we have less on A Bit of Culture, so you didn't get any publicity at all. All right, so there.
Oh dear.
But we're very
so select. Snarky. My goodness. No,
we are at A Bit of Culture. We are a very elite listenership.
Exclusive.
Yeah, we actually vet people. Dear. We're going to move on. But actually, you know, the subject matter of your webcast, the Serani aspect, is something we're going to be talking about a lot more actually in depth in our next talk.
Right after this.
Thank you, Bernice. Right after this, here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Vernon Adrian Among, and Bernice Chorley. And now topic number three. Earlier, apparently, I said the name wrong. It is Martina Rosells. She was the wife of Francis Light, the man who, I'm just going to say, founded Penang. She was of Siamese, Portuguese Eurasian descent. She and Francis Light, they met in when he was in Phuket. He was actually based in Phuket for many years before he ever went to Penang. I think he was running a reggae bar on the beaches in Phuket. Phuket was a very different place in those days. And it was a trading point, because the winds would blow down from India for 6 months and then they'd blow the other way. And it was like the end of the winds would take you to Kedah, Phuket, just about Penang. So he then also went with his then wife to Kedah. He was in Kedah for some time. He and she spoke all the local languages. She was involved in the negotiations for the ceding of Kedah, or the rent, rather, actually, the rent of Kedah from was it a rent? Did they rent?
Yeah, it was kind of.
Yeah, kind of, yes.
the rent of Penang from Kedah, and then they were married, kind of. Well, they were married.
Were they? Were they really?
Well in the documents, she's constantly referred to as his common law wife.
Common law wife, yes.
So that gives us an indication that perhaps maybe the British authorities never really recognized.
Yeah, well, at this point in the history of Malaya, we have to be careful if we say the British, because he was actually working for the East India Company.
Which was
British, but it was not part of the government. It was a business. And the East India Company did not allow its employees to marry or even be Catholic. And she was Catholic. So that may have also been a reason why he didn't own up to being married to Martina. Yeah. So they were then common law man and wife for 22 years. When he died, he bequeathed in his will everything to Martina. And he had quite a lot of land in Penang. But she was kind of systematically dispossessed. Out of her will by his business partners. But they had many children.
Five
Five children, one of whom, the most famous ones, William Light, who became the Surveyor General down in South Australia. And he is the man who is the fella who established Adelaide, the city of Adelaide. Yeah. So in a family, two generations in a family, established two different cities. Not bad. Vernon, I'm actually kind of inspired to talk about this because I watched an interview you made with one of the Lights, Martina Light descendants.
Well, Francis Light and Martina, yeah. Rosales' descendant, yeah.
Descendant.
Great, great, great granddaughter.
Who is American. She lives in America, and you spoke to her from, I think she was in San Diego.
Correct, yeah.
And it was
4th of July, by the way.
All right.
Wow.
And it was just really interesting to hear her talk about this, which she'd grown up kind of knowing that it was in the family tree.
Correct, yes.
But not quite knowing what it meant. And then when she sort of discovered it, and then she got in contact with other descendants and people in Malaysia, the Eurasian,
the Serani community, yeah.
Serani community. And then she felt a sense of real kinship with
all of them. Yeah, it was touching, wasn't it? Listening to her talk about it, where suddenly the stories that she heard from other members made so much sense. And she suddenly felt like as though she had found her own tribe, you know, because she says now she passes as white, but when she was young, she used to be picked on because she looked Asian, you know. So that whole situation of, you know, a sense of identity and heritage all came to the fore in her discussion of her remembrance of when she discovered our community. Just to add to the story, I mean, like, what's really interesting is Martina Rosales was part of the Serani community that came from Phuket and was brought to Kuala Kedah by Francis Lights. And there are various stories about what actually happened, because some people say that actually there was a historian at the Georgetown Festival about, you know, 4 years ago, 5 years ago. A historian, a Kedah historian, if I remember his name, Datuk Sharif, and he said that actually Martina Rosales might have been the daughter of the Sultan of Kedah. And therefore, the story might have been that he had a Serani concubine who had a daughter, and she took her mother's name because you are sent by the Sultan to actually persuade Francis Light to set up the East India Company in the Penang Island. And so it's going to be in a partnership with a British guy. Therefore, it was in a sense more appropriate for her to have another name. You know, another alter ego. Right. You know, so kind of like the Mata Hari, perhaps, of that. Yeah. But then there was true love, and they fell in love, and he actually bequeathed all his land. And apparently, in the wills, he also bequeathed her slaves.
Yes, you know? That's right.
And unfortunately, because of the very very shaky establishment of their relationship, you know, she was actually cheated of all that was left to her, including Suffolk House.
Well, was it all, the entire inheritance was taken away from her? Was she given everything?
If I remember correctly, there were major, the will does exist and it's listed out, but the one that was of great concern was Suffolk House, where she actually tried to get it back in court cases and stuff.
Yeah, so Bernice, this happened 100 years before your Captain Speedy, and then it was back in the 1700s. It was quite possible for an Englishman to marry an Asian, actually, and have kids. But by the time of Captain Speedy, that was just not possible. You just did not do that.
No,
but I guess it became more governed and more strict. Their corporate the corporate rules were, you know, how should I say, made stricter, and so there were no loopholes for you.
Also the branding. I mean, they wanted to promote a particular brand.
Yeah, yeah.
All white brand. The Twain Shall Meet. But you know of Martina, don't you, Bernice? I mean, you know a lot about her.
What? Martina Rosell?
Yeah, I mean, she's, unlike Speedy, she's a well-known character.
Mm, yeah. I was sort of doing some research again yesterday when you said that you were going to talk about her. I'm very curious to know what she actually looked like, because there are no actual depictions of what Frances like looked like either. And I think the statue in Penang now is modeled after his son, William. Is that correct, Vernon?
Yes, correct. Yeah, the son is, the statue is his William's likeness.
It's William's likeness. Yeah. But Martina, I mean, I was looking at pictures. There's one called The Malay Woman, and it does sort of, I think it resembles... Do you think that's the one, the depiction of her?
I would imagine she would look very Asian, you know? Yes. And remember that this is before even the identity label of Eurasian had been created. Mm. She probably would not have been referred to as Portuguese Eurasian. She would have probably been referred to as Sarani. And there are love letters in Jawi Malay written between Frances Light and Martina, which apparently does exist in London.
Oh, wow. So what was her first language then?
It probably would have been either Thai or Malay. Because they wrote letters in Jawi Melayu to each other.
So they probably communicated to each other in Malay.
Malay.
Yeah. Like my paternal grandmother spoke to my father in Malay, you know. And she was actually had a Chinese name, but her mother was Sarani. So she would have got her mother tongue from her mother, who was a Sarani woman. Virginie Jacob, you know, and therefore I would imagine back then, before the British came and made English the language of administration, I think it was all Malay and Jawi here.
So that means then also that the William Light, the man who founded Adelaide, his first language was probably Malay.
Yes, but he apparently was sent to school, to boarding school in England, which is to me a very interesting part of the story, because here was this mixed race boy being sent to attend boarding school. And so therefore, what would have his experiences been like, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
In that day and age when, you know, skin color and the way you looked, marked you. The way Margie Calladay was the descendant in the United States, you know, who, you know, even though she was born in England, you know, she was teased at school because she looked Asian.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was a fascinating interview. But we have to wrap this one up. But, in the Sarani world, if there is such a thing, Martina stands as, I get the impression, she stands pretty tall. She's like an important cultural icon.
Actually, yes and no. She hasn't been celebrated as much as I feel she should have. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that, apart from the fact that she is not the white person in the story, you know what I'm saying? She does kind of like is relegated to a secondary role against Frances Light and other British people. Therein is also the reason why I'm trying to. I have this passion to talk about Saraniness because it's also about matrilineal ancestry.
Sorry, matrilineal, was that?
Yes, as opposed to just matrilineal. I mean, like,
of course, yeah. Okay. So we're gonna move on though, Vernon.
Okay,
that's enough Sarani for now. Okay. All right. You have your own webcast. You can do that. We move to the final part of the show, recommendations, where I recommend something that we think might be of interest. And Bernice goes first.
Well, in celebration of your birthday, and I remember the time you took me driving around to Avebury in Wiltshire. Do you remember that? We looked at the stones.
Yeah.
So I would like to recommend this series called Mystic Britain, which is on the Smithsonian Channel, so you can get it on Apple TV. It's fantastic. It's, you know, everything runic about Britain. It looks at Stonehenge. It looks at, you know, Roman Britain. It looks at Hadrian's Wall. It looks at zombies. It looks at cannibalism. It looks at witchcraft. It's fabulous. It's really, really good.
It sounds very Bernice. You know, one thing I recently discovered, actually, was that the people who built Stonehenge, which was built around the same time as the pyramids, the people, that there was some devastating disease. It may have been, I can't remember, like smallpox or something, that went through the population of the British Isles and killed just about everybody. And then there was a complete population replacement from the continent. So actually, there are no descendants, pretty much, no descendants of the people who built Stonehenge in modern day England.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yeah. They all died.
Because there were quite a few different plagues. I mean, apart from the Black Plague, you know, there was sort of famine and there was volcanic eruptions as well that happened to the
every 100
century.
Years these days.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just, yeah, it's a very, very good series. It's really well researched. I mean, some of the artifacts are incredible. I just learned so much about, about Mystic Britain. So
Mystic Britain.
Yes, highly recommend it.
Available on your
legitimate
streaming service. Apple TV.
So,
Vernon, what's your recommendation?
My recommendation is actually this little booklet that I have here in my hand, which nobody can see, even though I'm holding it up against the Zoom camera. It's called Art in the City, and it's actually printed by Chandana. Okay. And what it does is it actually has a map of all the public installed art installations, sculptures, and building facades, and murals, etc., around KL. It's been put together by the very well-known Snow Ng, an art curator with her team, which includes Alan Wong, also another young artist. And it's really quite interesting because it's got little stories about every little piece of art installation around Kuala Lumpur, you know. So I'd like for people to perhaps maybe check it out. You can go to the chandana.com.my website and look it up. There should be a copy of it, a PDF copy of it there. And then maybe you can find out where you can pick up a hard copy.
What's it called again?
It's called Art in the City 2019. And it's got quite an amazing
open out map. It has a big map.
Yeah, it's got a map. Yeah, a big map. With all the public art installations and facades and sculpture and stuff.
Except that one's gone now.
In memory of Luna Peaks.
Vernon is doing something that that really doesn't work on radio. He's holding a map up to a camera. So listeners, use your imagination and imagine a map being held up in front of your face. So it's my turn. My recommendation is, a lot of people, they always come up to me in the streets and say, hey, Cam, is there a single volume history that really accurately describes the Congress of Vienna of 1815, where the map of Europe was shaped after the Napoleonic Wars? And I've always said, no, there isn't. But now there is. And it's a wonderful book that I've started reading. It's called The Rights of Peace. The Fall of Napoleon and the Congress of Vienna. And the reason why I like it, because it's written by a guy called Adam Zamoyski. He is, he's an American, lived in Britain, but he's actually of Polish descent. And when you read a lot of European histories written by, say British histories written by British people, it just gets so British-y, you know? It's like Tudors are going on about Henry VIII like he was some lovable character, but doesn't talk about anything outside of it. And Americans likewise. But actually, if you find really good Polish writers, often, because the Poles were the colonialized people of Europe. Their name was swallowed up by Russia, Austria, Prussia, and they see things differently. So because he's of Polish descent, he looks at history not from necessarily the great players, but sort of seeing the impact of these great historical moments on smaller nations and on people who were powerless in many ways. Whoa. To actually make a difference. So I read a biography he wrote of Napoleon, which was fantastic, but also his history of Poland is really great. And now this book, Rights of Peace. And now I'm doing something which is not good on radio. I'm holding up a book.
Rights of Peace.
Which is backwards. So, yeah. So, well,
that
brings us to the end of this week's show, where we have covered everything. we really have. So only remains for me now to thank Vernon Adrian Among. And how do we find your webcast, Vernon?
Oh, you can go to YouTube and look for Sarani Sembang.
Okay.
Cool.
That sounds easy. Yeah. And we thank Bernice Chorley. So, Bernice, you're studying up on Pera, is it? To write? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. It's a lot of reading. It's a lot of reading. And at some point, I just need to stop doing the research and start writing. So. But yeah, it's a fascinating time in history of this country, and I'm very, very proud to be, orang Perak, as they say, and hopefully write something else about Perak in the future.
Well, you know, inspired by Bernice Chorley, I've been writing about Perak as well, and
yay
about my grandparents, the world of theirs, and
great.
And also paralleling with my Welsh grandparents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So looking at the two different worlds.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So thank you for that.
I love it when all you biracial people, you know, do your stuff and intertwine your various cultures. It makes me feel not as strange.
But don't worry, Vernon, you are strange. you will always have the monopoly on that. So that brings us to the end of this week's show, and so thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
And everyone else out there, please join us again for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.